What's standing between you and your first sale on Shopify? Time, expertise, resources? What if you could multiply all three? Product descriptions? Done. Store insights? Delivered. 2 a.m. customer questions? Handled instantly. Entrepreneurs on Shopify are reaching their first sale faster with AI that works with you. Go to shopify.com/firstsale to see how entrepreneurs use AI to grow their businesses faster. That's shopify.com/firstsale.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
I'm excited to share with you part two of our series on what we can learn from the rare disease community. Last week, I had Bobby Glenn on the pod to talk about his journey navigating the healthcare system with his daughter, who has a rare disease. We also talked about intersections around stuttering and speech. Today, we have his wife, Nicole, to talk about her journey as a mom with a child with a rare disease, coupled with being a pediatrician. We also talk about stuttering and speech, and it's just a really great conversation. But before we get into part two, I have a few event alerts. We have a ton of events coming up. Our next one is in San Rafael, California, which is near San Francisco. That will be our Stuttering Awareness Week launch event. It will be on May 8th at 7 p.m. And the program will show documentaries on stuttering, and listeners get a free ticket. You can use the promo code PROUD, all caps, 25. And then we also have an event at the same venue in San Rafael on May 15th. We will be showcasing documentaries on disabilities featuring the Marley Matlin documentary, which premiered at Sundance. This is our official Stuttering Awareness Week event. And then a few more. We have a Philly Proud Stutter Gathering on May 19th in partnership with Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And last but not least, we have our date for our third annual gala, October 9th in San Francisco, California. And last thing, have you been missing our Survivor recaps? We will be back to cover the Survivor season finale, which is airing on May 21st. I'll be back with Caitlin and Elliot to recap that. And now on to the show. Welcome back to Proud Stutter. I'm joined by Nicole Glenn. Nicole is a pediatrician, and she's also a mother of a child with a rare disease. And we're here to talk about everything when it comes to being a mom, navigating being a pediatrician, advocacy within the healthcare system, all of those things. And Nicole, I'm so excited to have you on the Proud Stutter podcast.
Thanks, Maya. I'm really excited to be here.
So what's it like being both a mom of young children and being a pediatrician?
It's wonderful, but also tricky. I think there are so many great things about it. I feel more confident when it comes to simple questions. I can take care of things easily myself. I can recognize things very quickly. So that part's nice. Everyone's like, "Do you have to take your kids to the doctor?" And I'm like, "I mean, I still do." But so that part's great. But it's tricky. I think I actually even have admit to my own parents, my own patients, parenting is hard, and I feel like I have a parent hat and I have my doctor hat, and I don't always wear them both at the same time. So sometimes implementing things that I would recommend for my own patients to do for my own children is hard. And I struggle with that because I'm a human being who's flawed and imperfect. And so I have to remind myself, like, put on your doctor brain right now and not your mom brain. And those things can be hard to separate. And then there's the balance of also, I think a lot of docs struggle with sort of not underplaying things with your own kids, like, "You'll be fine, you'll be fine, you'll be fine." So sometimes we can be a little bit late to bring our kids into care because we, sort of know that generally kids do okay, and so we sort of blow things off. But then there's the other side of being overly worried and thinking about all the things that you know could go wrong, and so then sort of going down that spiral too of like, because you understand all the worst case scenarios, so trying to find a balance there is sometimes tricky.
You have a child with a rare disease. Can you talk about how you've navigated that from both like being a mom and also a pediatrician, and get into like early detection? Because that was actually a big topic that me and Bobby talked about a lot, but I'd love to kind of get like your journey with that, and then we can get into like the early detection importance.
Our early journey was definitely trickier than I thought it would be. I think I have come into my advocacy with her, and it has changed the way I practice. When I think about our early years, or especially that early, probably first year, so I definitely knew something was not right with Rosie. That's my daughter Rosie. Pretty early. I mean, even in our 20-week ultrasound, when you're pregnant, they go in for your 20-week sort of big scan, and she was not growing well, and they kept. It's interesting being a, this is where like coming, being a doctor, they will throw out words like, "Well, it's not microcephaly, but," and so then that's, a normal, I think a general non-medical person has no idea what they mean by that, but I do. So I found I left that first appointment so much more anxious than my husband did, because it's like I already started this thought process of like, okay, here we go. Here's a million things that could be wrong. So I think I was kind of pessimistic going into it. I think they kept trying to reassure me, and I was like, "This is not going to be okay. I just know it's not. This is, and that's what's so tricky, like not to foreshadow already into the screening of like when you start to see things going wrong, at what point do you say this is wrong versus, well, let's watch? And that's such a hard balance. And so I feel like we started that so early of like, it's probably going to be okay, but it might not be. And I just knew it wasn't going to be. So those first few weeks and months were really hard because she was not doing things that a typical newborn would do. And I was really surprised how I think my naivete as like a first-time mom was sort of taken into account of like, "Well, you're just nervous." And I was like, "No, I'm a pediatrician. Like I understand. I interact with newborns and infants all the time. This is not normal." And so there was a lot of like, "Let's see, let's see, let's see" in the beginning. But because I'm a doctor, I think I was taken seriously, even though I was kind of brushed off. It was like, "Well, if you really want to see neurology, we can do that. If you really want to see PT, we can do that," because I knew what to ask for. And so we did start early. I mean, we were in with the neurologist at 2 months of age, and we had a NICU stay early in her first couple months because she wasn't feeding well, and I was sort of persistent about it. And I got a lot of like, "Well, you're a pediatrician, you can handle this, you can handle this. I know you can watch her, so I'm not worried." And I was like, I don't want to do it. I want to be mom. So then like, so it was kind of a crash course in sort of that balance that we were talking about earlier. I think I look back on that all the time and think about what that would have been like if I hadn't been a physician, or would they have said things differently? And sort of then, from that appointment, because I had that in my mind, we pushed, and I talked to the neurologist again and said, sounds like they think she has cerebral palsy. Like, what, you know, where do we go from here? So I knew how to navigate the system. And so things probably did happen faster. But even still, we didn't get a diagnosis until she was three. And sometimes that blows my mind, too, that I know how to advocate. I know how to use the system. I can get us into appointments quickly. And it still took me till three to get a diagnosis for her. So it has absolutely changed the way I think about what it's like to be a patient, what it's like to be a parent, how I listen to parents. So it's absolutely changed my whole practice.
And as far as like learning through this, not only as a pediatrician, but also like, I'm wondering like through your experience, are there like things you're advocating for so that, you know, this journey can be better for like parents in the future?
We all understand the idea that early intervention is important. But I think sometimes the diagnostic piece gets left behind. We're very good at, okay, you should see PT. You should see speech therapy. We should get you into a developmental specialist. And I hear that argument sometimes when the diagnostic part of it gets pushed behind. It's like, well, we're doing all the things anyway. We're doing the things we would do with or without a diagnosis. And I think there is a little bit of a lack of education and kind of catching up that the diagnostic part is really important, particularly when it comes to genetic disorders. Because I will say, even with Rosie, they offered us genetic testing. So the thing that I'm pushing for earlier is earlier genetic testing, earlier diagnostics, because we're doing the intervention piece. But even when I had that opportunity and had that conversation, you know, we did a lot of testing early and then we sort of stopped because we thought we weren't going to find anything. And what difference is it going to make if we do find something? I don't think I had any, I had that old dogma of like, you can't do anything about it. So what does it really change? And so that's something that I feel really passionate about now. And a lot of other moms that I know who have kids with rare genetic, particularly genetic disorders, feel really strongly that like, we need to get kids diagnosed earlier because it does make a difference. It's made a huge difference for not only just answers and like that why, that seeking that parents go through, that sort of self-blaming that you go through, what did I do? Having answers helps with that so much. But then community, and I'm sure that's something that you probably relate to a lot. Having a community is so important. People that are going through what you're going through that can relate to your experience, that you can sort of feel bonded to, because especially in rare disease, it's so, there's, you don't know anyone else, it's rare. And so having those connections are huge. And then the third part is there are therapeutics, there is things happening. My daughter's enrolled in a clinical trial. And so I feel lucky. There are a lot of rare genetic disorders that they're not even starting to develop a research team to figure out where to go. And so we're lucky that there is, but you have to start somewhere. And so, you know, you're never gonna get to the stage of developing therapeutics if you don't understand what it is and how it works. And so having a gene identified or having some sort of, you know, physical understanding of what's happening, what's causing it, is one of the ways you can then develop the next steps. So I think that the diagnosis is so important. And a lot of it's education for the providers as well as parents that like, no, we should be looking for this. We can do something about it. And it's important to try to find that answer.
Yeah. And just relating this to stuttering, I feel like something that Mia and Bobby talked about too is, you know, while there is a lot of research around stuttering, I feel like we're still not super close to finding a definite cause and finding like a cure. Not that like that's my, like me personally, a cure for stuttering isn't as front of mind. Like obviously that's like, that would be amazing, but I'm more about like, okay, here's this situation we're in, how can we like make lives better for people who stutter versus trying to find a cure. But at the same time, I still feel like there isn't that energy. There isn't that, like, I think we could be doing a lot more in stuttering research. And I think a lot of that has to do with like people not really understanding stuttering and it maybe not being like an issue that people think is important. And so I think that can go into why, you know, there might not be a lot of, you know, then we might not be as far in the research as we could or should be. And so I'm wondering, like, how do we make sure that this research is happening and that we're, even though we not might be a huge amount of the population, it's still important to have research done and to have this type of like these issues being discussed.
I wanted to touch first on what you said about that balance between cure and let's say acceptance. Like, I think that we see that a lot in the neurodevelopmental community with autism, with genetic disorders. My kid doesn't need a cure. They don't need to be fixed. But at the same time, it would be nice. I'm sure it would be nice to have either not stutter or have your stuttering be improved. But because you know that that's not happening tomorrow, we understand the importance of acceptance and support and feeling like it's okay that I'm this way. And those are completely opposite things. How do you kind of reconcile, I'm okay the way I am, but I also want to make it better. And so I love the idea that two completely opposite things can coexist. My daughter is perfect the way she is. That doesn't mean I don't want to find a treatment for her. Autistic people don't need to be fixed, but I'm sure there are things they would like their struggle to be easier for them, right? And there are challenges that go along with all of these different neurodevelopmental disorders. And so I think that people feel like you have to be put into one category or the other. You know, are you on the cure path, or are you just trying to be neurodivergently affirming? Can't it be both? And so I think that duality is really important, because we need acceptance. We need better support systems. We need ways for people to feel seen, and we need disabilities to be in the public eye and not have them be things that people feel ashamed about or hidden, that this is part of life. We can also work to make that easier, better, to help reduce those challenges, but still do both at the same time. And I would imagine that a lot of stuttering gets probably blamed on things that it's not, that that's not the cause. And I think that that, and then that creates more, what's the word I'm looking for? Like more stigmatism, right? Like, oh, this is, so I think that's where, again, that advocacy piece of like, no, this is, there is a genetic component, or there is something, and, you know, are the treatments we have actually helping? And are those treatments being informed by people who are going through them? And so I think the patient role in research and in treatments is becoming more important as we're, you know, thinking about adults who live with these maybe childhood onset things. How do they feel about it now? How would they want to see it done? And how do we sort of circle that back to now with the kids, thinking through, okay, you know, would it be different to have a speech therapist who stutters actually helping kids who stutter, because that versus someone who doesn't? And not to say that you have to have that disorder to be able to do it, but I think there needs to be that informed process. I think that people who are developing these treatments, it's helpful to get the input of people who have been through it. And so I think that's where your patient advocacy piece comes in really big. And, you know, as a community, how do you make sure that your voices are heard, that you're feeling like your treatments are affirming of your disorder, but also helping you, and that we're using as much evidence as we can, you know, because evidence-based treatments are important. That's how you know it's actually working. And we don't always have that evidence. So if you don't have that, then how do you at least create some sort of guidelines or something to make sure that people are getting appropriate treatment? So that's tricky. And I think patient advocacy is becoming huge. Like, you know, parents or patients' role in pushing the needle forward with medicine is happening. I mean, a lot of parents, especially in the rare disease world, you were saying, like, you know, when you have such a small population, how do you make sure that it it matters. That's where I think the parent, the patient group, and I always say parent because it's my kid, but the patient group is so critical for that, because it does matter to us. It matters to your small group. And so just because your numbers are small doesn't mean that that's not meaningful. But how do you get the larger population to care? That's tricky. And that's where sometimes then it becomes sort of your passion project to say, this matters to my community. We're not going to let our voices be ignored. We're going to push this forward. We're going to try to find people who are interested in this. And it ends up being very patient driven. And that's how like a lot of research in rare disease starts. It's with the patient saying, we need to fix this, and then going out themselves and finding somebody who's interested and starting the trials and raising the money. And we do, and you know, so it's a very backwards way of traditional thinking. My colleagues are like, I can't believe you guys are driving all this forward. And I'm like, I can't sit around and wait for someone to be interested in this. It's so small. There's 150 kids in the world with this disorder. It's not like someone's going to just suddenly be like, I'm interested and want to help. So that advocacy has to come from us.
So the yearly checkups, like when kids get their yearly checkups, I know that there's like eyes, ears. Can you like walk through like what that is right now? Because I think one of the things that I think would be really helpful for like, let's say stuttering, is to also have like that speech component as part of like that yearly checkup piece. So yeah, I just wondering if you can walk through that and where you see like if you have any ideas about what should be added, I guess.
I mean, we have, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics plus the CDC, or, you know, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, all the different people that are involved in sort of setting these guidelines. We have very specific ways that we go through the developmental surveillance and screening. Surveillance meaning you're watching and getting all the data, and screening meaning very specific sort of tools or things you're supposed to do to sort of test for certain things at certain ages. And we have all these milestones, you know, you're supposed to be able to do X by X date. And so they have changed that recently. And, you know, because initially it was like the milestones were based on 50% of the kids are supposed to be able to do that thing by that age. And they've actually pushed it to like, okay, well, let's make sure it's 75% of the kids are supposed to be able to do that thing by that age. So it changes. And that's what I love about being a pediatrician, is what I do at a 2-month visit, a 6-month visit, a 1-year visit, 5-year visit, they're different, but it's a lot to keep track of. And so there's, you know, we always think about growth. We always do, like you said, eyes, ears, like sort of the physical stuff. But with pediatrics, that developmental piece is huge. Are you talking? Are you walking? What's your social interaction like? What's your social emotional environment? What's your sort of, what are your determinants of social health? Are you, you know, what's your sleep like? What's your family dynamics like? So we have a ton to get into almost at every visit. It can be overwhelming because there's so many things that affect a child's development. And so it's my job to be kind of checking in and trying to keep the pulse on all of these different things. Language is a big one. And there are very early markers of language development. And there's so, and language is so complex. There's, you know, your receptive language, what do you understand? There's your expressive language. There's like sort of the social communication part of language. And so it, that's something you really have to understand and be on top of, and to try to catch, you know, issues that may arise. So that part is tricky. And that's why it's important that, you know, that relationship with your pediatrician, I think, is key. And that's what I love about, you know, I think you're more likely to miss issues if you don't see the same person every time. And that's why having sort of like a provider who knows you, knows your family, can track along with you is so important. So that's what I do love about my job, is, you know, developing those relationships with families and being able to see things over time, and creating plans for when we feel like things are not going on track. So how do we figure out, okay, at what point do we need to make some intervention?
That's really helpful, because I think, because one of the things that has stuck with me about like my stuttering journey with my mom is, she said that she took me in to see a specialist when I was in middle school, and she said, oh, if you would have seen me when Maya was like 5, I could have cured her. I have learned to really love my stutter because it's kind of gotten me to where I'm at now, and I really love my life, and I love that I'm able to do Proud Stutter and all these things. But then there's this like, like in hindsight thing, like what could I have done better? And I feel like my mom feels like, you know, like if she understood stuttering more. So there's just that dynamic that that I really empathize with, because I feel like a lot of parents out there really want to do what's best for their child who stutters. And it's not really a question, but I'm wondering if like any of that resonates, or if you have any response to that.
That struck me so much. Like, I'm sure, and maybe I shouldn't assume, but I bet that your mom felt really guilty about that. Like, oh, I should have done something. I could have cured her. And those definitive statements, we don't know that for sure. And I hope that that's getting better, because I think so often different healthcare providers will say something like it is just so black and white. And sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. And the ifs and what if and if onlys keep you awake at night, and those statements get burned into your brain forever. I talk to so many families of all kinds of with different disorders, and there's always one statement that somebody made that like just is burned into their brain and they carry with them forever. And I wonder how often I've done that to families. And I think about that a lot. Like, God, I need to be so careful about how I talk to them, because this is their kid. This is so, so impactful for them. And I don't want to make families feel guilty. And I don't want to throw people under the bus and say, oh, you should have, would have, could have. So I imagine that, like, and so I can totally just like feel that for you and carrying that and the wondering what would have been different. And I think parents don't ever want to feel like they didn't do enough. Of course, that your mom probably did as much as she thought she could. Of course she did. And she's not the medical professional. And that's where this distrust for the system is sometimes growing. It's supposed to be a partnership, and we're supposed to be helping patients make good decisions and giving them information to make that, and to try to, you know, have sort of patient-centered care. It's not just this is what I say and this is what you should do. There needs to be joint discussion there, and that's a shift that needs to be happening. And it's not just physicians, it's therapists, it's nurses, it's you know audiologists, all the people in the field who interact with you. But at the same time, it's the practice of medicine, it's the art of medicine. It's not always as definitive, and there's a lot of, you know, changing guidelines, and you know, we're trying to keep up with the school of thought. And so I'm sure maybe that the providers that your mom interacted with thought that they were also doing their best, right? I don't think there's any ill intention on either side necessarily. And so it's just human nature. So I think we still have a long way to go in terms of finding that balance, because I think sometimes as we push families to advocate more, I do see sometimes the physician pushback of like, oh, the parents come in with this whole plan and this is what they want to do, and they don't even want to hear my expertise. And so how do we, again, help build a relationship on trust where both sides are heard and it's a team approach, and you understand the family, the patient brings the expertise of what's going on with their body, and you bring your expertise of understanding disease and treatment and those things. And how do you make your goals, their goals and your goals, like align together? Because sometimes I do have to say, I understand this is a really important thing to you. However, I'm very worried about X, Y, or Z because it could have some serious complications. And so that's where I can't only just do what my patient wants. I have to think about things that they're not thinking about. But again, it needs to be a decision together.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Speech intersects with so many different, like, either if it's like a rare disease or, you know, other things that, like developmental disabilities, like all these things. I feel like communication and speech are so interrelated. And I feel like there's so much we can do intersectionally, like you being on this podcast and like if we could all kind of help our communities out in different ways by amplifying each other's stories. And so I think what's coming up for me is just like, I'm wondering, like, what is Rosie's communications journey? And like, what, cause, like, is there, like, how does she communicate right now? And like, what is kind of like, I guess the trajectory of her communications journey, if you have that? I'm just curious. Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you. Communication is, we're really starting to understand more about communication and language and getting through the old ideas about what's a valid form of communication. You know, speech is used to be the gold standard. We need to get this person talking. That's not true. And I think that that's changing a lot in that all communication is valid. And I'm hearing that a lot and finally seeing that a lot more in the various speech therapists that we work with and the various, you know, patient advocates, that any communication is valid and important and we should be encouraging whatever works. And so that's where our journey, it did take a lot of pushing to get Rosie where she's at today. So she has been generally nonverbal, did some early babbling and had a couple early words. And then we had a pretty big regression around age 3 and she lost all of that. So she doesn't say anything now, even though she used to say like mama, up, da-da, that kind of stuff. And so there was, you know, always, of course, in the beginning, a big push for verbal speech. And then we tried sign language, which she doesn't have the motor control with her hands to do that. Then for a while, we were working on sort of like a picture exchange system. That's a whole other way of sort of, you know, pointing to different pictures or you're exchanging cards with pictures on it. It's cumbersome and hard. And there's this big movement to try to change the old adage of like, you have to prove competency before you can actually sort of move on to something. So a lot of children now, I don't know how familiar you are with what's called AAC or augmentative communication, augmentative adaptive communication. And so a lot of times that can look like, again, cards or sort of different visual things. For Rosie, we are using an iPad with different pictures. So she can, you know, say, you know, my name is Rosie, or I'm hungry, or I want this, or I want that. And then how do we expand beyond just simply requesting things to like being able to share your thoughts? And so some kids can touch, some kids need to use eye gaze machines to be able to do that. And so, I mean, this, the way of opening up communication for nonverbal children and adults is huge. But I think there are some people who still discourage that, like, oh, well, don't do that because then they'll never talk. Is that bad if they never talk? They can communicate? Like, again, sort of thinking about your stutter, like, we need to be supporting people where they are and not trying to force them into something else. I would be super happy if Rosie could tell me everything she wants, even if a word never comes out of her mouth, if she can do it with her iPad. I just want to know what her thoughts are and be able to hear her and be able to have her advocate for herself. I don't care how she does it. And so giving people the tools to do whatever they need to get their point across, I think is key. And then, you know, so we did get a lot of pushback in the beginning that she can't do it. She can't do it. So it took us a really long time to get her started on an iPad because we kept hearing, oh, she doesn't have the basic skills that are needed to do that. And so we finally kind of came across some therapists that are like, that's not true. You don't need to prove competency to be able to do this. Let's just start using it. We don't, she doesn't have, there are no prerequisites, which we kept hearing, oh no, she can't do this, she can't do that, so she won't be able to do it. And so then once we finally found someone who could sort of break down that barrier for us, she started doing it. And so she, you know, we still have, she's, it's not like she's telling me, hi mom, good morning, I want this. We're still a lot of practice, but she definitely gets her point across and will tell me, I don't like it, or I want this, or, you know, will sometimes surprise me with how very clear she is with her iPad and telling me what she wants. And other times it's like, I don't know, you just push 10,000 buttons, kid. I have no idea which one. You just said you want like 1,000 things. But that's kids too. I mean, how often does my son say, I want this, I want that, I want, you know? So some of that's natural of like, she's just like telling me all the things. And so it was amazing to finally see someone give her voice and do that and really open up her world for her. And I think a lot of parents, it's hard to find someone who will do that. And it breaks my heart when I see kids who are kind of being held into like, no, we have to do it this way. I'm like, it doesn't have to be that way. There's so many ways of communicating. And I think to go back, like what you were saying, the intersectionality of everything, language is complicated, Maya, and I'm not going to pretend to understand it, but why do people decide to talk at a certain age? Why, how come some people can write beautifully but can't speak it? How come some people, you know, really have so much trouble socially communicating, but are, you know, have so much, there's so many parts to communication, the fluency, the stuttering, the social emotional aspect of it all. It's complicated. And I don't think people realize sort of the depth of what's all involved in communication. And that is such a human piece for us, the way we share our thoughts, what we're thinking. It's one of the things I think that I think about the most. Like if I have any desire for my daughter, it's really for her to be able to express herself and to be heard and to feel like she has her voice, whether it's her real voice or her iPad or her eye gaze or whatever, but to be able to, you know, connect and communicate on that level. Well, probably more than anything, more than whether she's walking or feeding herself or all the other things, because I think that is such that like human spirit, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that was a beautiful place to end. That was such a beautiful, like, tying up of everything in a hopeful message, really, because, yeah, it's really, like, our world is so beautiful in all its complexities, and like we're each so unique, and the more we kind of move away from like you have to fit in all these boxes to really like embracing everyone's beauty in different ways. So you both are such beautiful parents, and thank you for just sharing your hearts with me.
I'm happy to. I think that, you know, telling our story is how we connect, how we feel human and recognize that this is life and we're in it together. And how do we embrace and accept all different, you know, ways people navigate their journey through life. And the more we can accept and understand each other, the less alone we feel, the more united we feel. So I'm happy to share.
That's it for this episode of Proud Stutter. This episode of Proud Stutter was produced and edited by me, Maya Chupkov. Our music was composed by Augusto Deniz, and our artwork by Mara Ezekiel and Noah Chupkov. If you have an idea or want to be part of a future episode, visit us at www.proudstutter.com. And if you like the show, you can leave us a review wherever you are listening to this podcast. Want to leave us a voicemail? Check out our show notes for the number to call in. More importantly, tell your friends to listen too. Until we meet again, thanks for listening. Be proud and be you.
What's standing between you and your first sale on Shopify? Time, expertise, resources? What if you could multiply all three? Product descriptions? Done. Store insights? Delivered. 2 a.m. customer questions? Handled instantly. Entrepreneurs on Shopify are reaching their first sale faster with AI that works with you. Go to shopify.com/firstsale to see how entrepreneurs use AI to grow their businesses faster. That's shopify.com/firstsale.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.